Welcome to From the Booth, a podcast hosted by the International Cinema Program at BYU. I'm Chip Oskerson, and I'm here with co-host Mark Yamada.
Great to be here.
And once again, as we do on every week in From the Booth, we will spend the next few minutes talking about the films that played at International Cinema here at BYU last week, and then we'll turn to previewing the coming week's films. As we discussed last week's films, we'll assume that you've seen them and not give any spoiler alerts, so if you're worried about us talking about important plot points, you can use the time codes we provide to skip ahead to the previews of next week's films, where we promise no spoilers. This was Opera Week at...
Opera Week,
yes. ...at International Cinema. And as I think I mentioned earlier on a previous episode, this is kind of a tribute to Don Marshall, you know, who was the longtime director of International Cinema, has a great love of opera. Mm. And in building our archive, which you can find on our website, you see how often they showed films of opera. Hmm. And I think that, you know, once upon a time, this was a greater part of the curriculum, you know, for better or for worse. Yeah, we were talking a little bit before we started recording about opera. And is opera a generational thing? I don't know. What do you think? Do younger students connect with opera in the way maybe they used to? Or has it always been a tough sell?
I think they do in a way they don't understand, which is they still like all the emotion and, you know, the music and things like that, but maybe they get in a different form than opera itself. But
there's different vehicles today. Well, this was an interesting collection of films. So the films that we showed, the first one was Elektra, a 1989 staging of the Strauss-Hofmannsthal opera Elektra, recorded at the Vienna State Opera House, directed by Brian Large. This was in German. Then we had Farewell, My Concubine. This is a nod to Peking opera to kind of diversify things a little bit. An award-winning Mandarin language film from 1993. And then we had The Magic Flute, a 1975 adaptation of Mozart's opera by none other than Swedish giant director Ingmar Bergman. And then lastly, our non-opera film, our documentary, was Mankiller, about Wilma Mankiller, the first woman principal chief of the Cherokee Nation from 2017, directed by Valerie Redhorse. Let's talk about the operas first, and then we'll talk about the documentary. So Elektra can be a challenging sort of thing, and I think in the abstract, this was a challenging film piece of art for the students in the International Cinema class. It wasn't the one that they all rushed out to see.
No.
And this is, you know, pretty understandable that it's, even as in terms of opera, it's not what we typically associate with opera insofar that it's really avant-garde. And right. It's both in its staging as well as, I think, in its construction. When Strauss put this together, he was intentionally kind of thumbing his nose at classicism. Mm. Interesting to, you know, pick a classical mythology to do that with. We had a post-screening discussion with Dr. Roger McFarland from our classics program here, and he made some really interesting points that helped me to see a little bit more what was going on and why Strauss and von Hofmannsthal maybe chose to do what they did in the staging of this opera. Hugo von Hofmannsthal, of course, wrote the libretto for it. It was based on a stage adaptation that he had done just a few years before. The way that Dr. McFarland put this is that they seem to be trying to show civilization at its absolute low point, right? like this is where civilization is bottoming out. And of course, as I, you know, thought about this, this very much dovetails with this idea of decadence. That's a very prominent artistic movement around turn of the 20th century. And so it makes a lot of sense, right? So the basic storyline is Elektra's father has been murdered. Agamemnon's been murdered, right, by his wife. And Elektra can't let it go. Mm. And so the way that this is staged, Elektra sees herself as trying to hold together, I mean, her demands for justice and for vengeance, she sees as that this is holding civilization together. Like, if we can't expect justice, if we can't kind of, you know, put out these demands, then what do we have? You know, anything goes. And this, of course, is a real problem for her. It's complicated by the whole, you know, the whole kind of mythology behind this, because of course Agamemnon on the throne, you know, did he actually have a right to that throne? Or, you know, this is going back several generations now, he ascended to the throne illegitimately, you know, perhaps. And so it's complicated. You know, it's not so straightforward as Elektra wants to think it is. And it's that messiness that that we're presented with. This particular staging, I thought, was interesting. It's very expressionist in feel. Mm. And what I mean by that is that it's, everything is kind of exaggerated, that everything takes place. It's a one-act opera, so you don't have a lot of scene changes, but it all takes place that there's this giant, monumental statue of Agamemnon that's broken in pieces.
Right.
And so everything is taking place around the statue. And so Agamemnon is always on stage. He's always haunting the scene. And Electra, of course, is kind of moving around the space. There are these interesting ropes that are hanging down that she gets. This is how she dies at the end. She's like tangled in these ropes. And it's very evocative, right, of the kinds of themes that it's trying to get at. Eva Marton, who's plays the part of Electra, all I can say is she's just amazing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the voice and doing this for, the amount of time that she's doing it is really impressive. Having said all of that, it's very modernist, right?
Yeah.
That it's, I don't, I'm not particularly adept in musical analysis, but it's very avant-garde in how it's playing out. One interesting thing that was pointed out to me is that every character has a key that they're singing in, except for Electra, right? That she's this kind of free radical that's kind of moving around that can't find a place. And this is what the whole drama is about.
Right.
Does it grate, on you? Absolutely, and it's supposed to, right?
It's supposed to, yeah.
That's kind of the point of it. But, it also maybe helps to explain why this wasn't the film that students were running out to see. They were a little bit scared off. But I can appreciate what's going on an intellectual and theoretical
right.
level, even as sometimes the music doesn't speak to me as much as it maybe speaks to other people.
Yeah, what's great about looking at these films at international cinemas, we're looking at the play itself, we're analyzing the play, but we're also looking at it kind of through film as well. So it's kind of another layer of what's going on cinematically and what the directors are trying to bring out of the original play itself. So interesting. Another thing that we'll talk about in terms of the magic flute coming up. But
yeah, and you see a very different approach that Bergman takes to filming opera as opposed to Brian Large, which is, this is the derogative term that we use sometimes, is that it's kind of canned theater, right? It's literally a performance that's taking place in real time on stage,
right,
that he's set up, different cameras. And there's a limitation that comes with that.
Right.
I mean, it's great on the one hand in that you get this feel of the performance. You get the audience applauding at the end and the actors, kind of coming out at the end and things like that. But it's not terribly cinematic in terms of really embracing
true.
The medium the way that Bergman chooses to do.
Magic Flute does a lot more, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Farewell, My Concubine is a different kind of thing altogether. I mean, this is not performed opera. There's a lot of opera performance in the film, but
right.
it's not itself a performed opera.
Right. It's more about the world of opera, particularly Peking opera, also known as Beijing opera, also known as Chinese opera. So many different names. And, it's a style of opera. It's music, it's storytelling, it's vocal performance. You have mime, you have dance. So it's really this kind of visual performance style that developed in China in kind of the early modern period, 18th and 19th centuries, really came into form it is now in the middle of the 19th century. And in the film, you're dealing with the 20th century. And at that point, Beijing opera is really kind of at its height in popularity and kind of maybe stylistic innovation. But what's really interesting about this film is that, as you mentioned, you're getting performances within the film, but you're also getting kind of this backdrop of political, historical trends that are going on in the 20th century in China. The Japanese invasion in the 1930s, World War II, and then you're getting the Cultural Revolution and how Beijing opera developed in some ways despite these things, how it is a link in some ways to pre-revolutionary China and then kind of this post-revolutionary kind of communist China, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at opera. So you're getting that operatic kind of element, but also kind of historical, to kind of fight against each other a little bit. But, the Cultural Revolution, I think, is an interesting to think about in terms of this play, because you're getting a little bit of that towards the end, especially. And the Cultural Revolution was this communist movement by Chairman Mao, 1960s and 1970s, about 10 years, where you had this attempt to really kind of purge the culture of more kind of capitalistic traditional elements. I think we saw this with Fencer a little bit, right? Where this idea that fencing, the cultural elements that were considered to be indicative of a particular class, fencing or aristocratic, were things that were being purged, right, from the culture a little bit, or maybe kind of not necessarily purged, but in the case of Chinese opera, but reformatted or resignified almost to kind of serve a revolutionary purpose.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. I was reading a little bit about Chinese opera during the Cultural Revolution. I was thinking that maybe it was discontinued or that it was kind of censored or banned, but it was repurposed as a way of expressing these revolutionary ideas. And so you'd actually stage Chinese operas that were thematically based on revolution and kind of more modern, you know, stories. And so it was repurposed for that goal of expanding revolution, of in some ways winning the hearts and minds, right, of people during that time.
Well, that's really interesting because the story, Farewell My Concubine, there's kind of stories within stories here, right? So Farewell My Concubine is the title, of course, of our film, but it's also the title of a well-known
of a play.
Opera, right, that's being performed in, you know, kind
within the
movie itself. And so, but that story is in some ways being acted out by the main characters, right? And this idea of repurposing then is really interesting that, you know, can the story Farewell My Concubine be repurposed by a socialist revolution?
Yeah, and it seems like it can, because the story itself has been staged in many different ways, depending on what is being accentuated or the different elements of the plot that are being pulled out. And so you get maybe that question too of can we repurpose this medium, right, to serve a kind of a revolutionary cause? Or is it in some ways, and from what I understand, before the Cultural Revolution, a lot of art theater was subversive. And so this was kind of the idea of kind of making it more, get in line with kind of the overall political agenda of the time. But that's an interesting way of thinking about the way in which plays are kind of repurposed, even in adaptation, right? And the way that we kind of screen them today, or that we perform them today as a way of dealing with modern concerns.
Well, I know that the film, when it first came out, had kind of a tortured interaction with the Chinese censor. and I wonder if part of it is, I mean, the story itself is all about loyalty in the face of defeat,
right?
That the concubine that remains doggedly loyal to the defeated emperor or warlord, I'm not sure which. And so there's something subversive by its very nature,
right?
And so the idea that you could somehow you could tame this and make it palatable, you know, to get by the communist censors in 1993. I mean, maybe that was part of what the problem was all along.
And that's interesting. Think about censors as being kind of these sophisticated readers of these plays, and you know, I guess maybe introducing the cinematic level and making it kind of the story within a story. I mean, you might confuse them, or they might not understand.
But sophisticated readers, right?
But yeah, that's always an interesting question about how censorship works in relation to stories and plays, and what things they recognize as being subversive, and in some ways, how you can repurpose it to make the subversive seem almost, you know, in line with the ideology, or in some ways to punish that. You know, because in some ways you could argue that this film is a tragedy in the sense that the main characters, I mean, there's a certain kind of sadness that, you know, that leads towards the end especially. So, you know, you kind of wonder how it was presented, right, in that way.
Right.
But, yeah.
I thought one of the interesting things that came out of this, too, from our lecture from Francesca Lawson, Dr. Lawson from Interdisciplinary Humanities. She's an ethnomusicologist that specializes in music from the Far East, and had some interesting things to say about gender and gender fluidity, because you get a lot of, you know, male performing female roles, that this is how it's traditionally done.
Right.
And they play with this very much in this film, right? That there's this kind of fluidity, you know, kind of back and forth that, you know, quite frankly was very confusing for me as a Western, you know, audience member, not quite understanding how gender is perceived. But I thought that this was a really interesting thing that she brought out, that it's that there is this this kind of performative aspect to gender that's kind of baked into the, you know, the art form, and was actually changed by Western influences, you know, later on, where gender roles became a little bit more rigid and this became more strange.
Yeah, and you see that for sure. And I think in some ways the gender dynamics spill out, obviously, into kind of the larger story, which involves kind of a love triangle, right, of sorts between. But it's a hard love triangle to figure out, because it's hard to figure out where the attraction and where the, you know, the connections lie. And so you definitely have a little bit of that. And it's hard to figure out in terms of, you know, applying maybe kind of a Western sense of a love triangle and seeing how the conflict. But yeah, you have obviously a character who plays the woman's role in the play. And then in some ways that kind of carries over a little bit into their real life experience and relationships. And it's an interesting, I mean, you know, Asian drama, a lot of it from the Japanese tradition as well, men traditionally would play the women's roles. But there's a weird kind of going back and forth that oftentimes men would, by playing women's roles or by writing in from the perspective of a woman, would allow them a little bit more of an artistic expression. During early on in the pre-modern era in Japan in particular, men would have to write in this very kind of rigid Chinese language, and the women wrote in the more kind of literary style. And so men would often kind of take on women's persona in order to be able to write in a more literary way.
Well, and maybe there's a political allegory in there as well, yeah. Right? So, you know, why is he doing this in 1993? Why poking at these themes, bringing up this gender fluidity? You know, maybe there's a kind of ventriloquism that he's trying to draw right. upon to make his own, you know, political critique,
yeah.
you know, going sure. on. Yeah, that's interesting. I just felt like there was, you know, so much there in this film, and only yeah. some of it I had access to. The Magic Flute is one of my favorite opera adaptations to film, in part, I think, because it very much was Bergman. I mean, Bergman doesn't limit himself to simply filming what's on stage. Now, having said that, the setting of this is really interesting because he chooses to set, and when I mean set, he kind of creates this frame, starting with the overture, where we're in and around the Drottningholm Royal Theater, which is a theater that was built out at the castle at Drottningholm by Gustav III back in the 1700s. So it's a Baroque theater that's still in functioning working order. It's really kind of a remarkable story. It looks like everything is being filmed there, and, right. and there are certain scenes that he has filmed there. So he's not hiding the theatricality of it, quite the opposite. It's yeah. all about kind of focusing on the theatricality. He did this in 1975 when it came out. I think it was the 50th anniversary of Swedish radio or something like that that they did this for. And kind of gives it this, you know, this look like it's there, but he's actually reconstructed the theater to film kind of on us in a studio. But we constantly feel like we're in this space. The overture, how do you do an overture, right? It's, you know, what are you going to show during an overture? Bergman makes an interesting choice, and in that during this overture, when there's nothing going on stage, he starts with some shots of the royal grounds kind of around the palace and the theater, but most of it, by and large, is looking at the faces of audience members.
Right.
And so from the very beginning, he has this kind of Brechtian alienation effect kind of thing going on, where he's reminding you again and again and again that you're watching a spectacle, right? And so, and he cuts in throughout the film. There are these key moments where he cuts in and he shows the faces of audience members, particularly this one little girl.
Yeah.
It's almost as if we're supposed to be looking at it through her eyes, but at the same time, every time we come back to her, we're like, oh yeah, this is just being staged. This is just, you know, kind of an opera. And,
yeah.
and the, you know, one of the key lines that he really draws out from, you know, from Mozart's opera is where Tamino at one point, after having seen the, you know, the Queen of the Night, and she disappears, finds himself alone on stage, and he asks the question, am I dreaming or is this real?
Yeah.
Right. And that borderline between fiction and reality, this has been a fascination for Bergman and lots of his work, of course, that there is not a clear cut line between these two things, that the world of film, on the one hand, of course, it's staged, of course, it's theatrical. But the reason why it engages us is because it connects on some kind of real level, you know, as well. And so even something as fanciful as the Magic Flute, where you have, you know, all kinds of, you know, mythical, you know, unrealistic, you know, characters and events, there's something more real than real in it. That's why it speaks to us. That's why we still watch this opera, you know, after 200 years, that it still has something to say to us that we feel is speaking to reality, I think.
I like how it dislocates our perspective in some ways as a viewer, because as you were mentioning, we see about 10 minutes or so during the overture of these audience members. And so in some ways, this seems to be kind of our focalization point within the story, but then it never shows us the play from their perspective so much as that it actually kind of enters the theatrical through film, right? I mean, you're
right.
getting...
Yeah, he's dissecting the space cinematically in the way you
rather
expect.
Than kind of having us see it as a theater goer, right? We're actually going in and we have angles, we have shot reverse shots, we have...
Close-ups. The whole thing,
yeah. Even from the beginning. And so it's an interesting way in which he's kind of... theater and kind of the diegetic world of theater and then film kind of collide in some ways. You know?
Yeah, no, that, I think that's a very good observation. I love too how the characters are on and off stage, right? So because he's not filming this in the literal space of the Drottningholm Theater, he's able to follow the characters like during intermission, where they're kind of wandering around backstage. The Queen of the Night is smoking a cigarette underneath the sign that says, you know, do not smoke in three languages. And so the characters they bleed out of the fictional space actually.
I mean, that going back to that idea, I think in some ways we're not so much seeing the play. But we're seeing the filming of the play. That's what he wants us to see. And so we're seeing. She doesn't, the audience member, the little girl that we have access to, doesn't have access to what we see, which is a backstage. Right. We're seeing all of that. And that's what he's giving us. Is kind of, it's more the filming of the play somewhat, as opposed to kind of this opera shown through us through film, right?
Yeah. Well, and Bergman's mastery as a director of theater really comes out as well. Of course, this is where he felt most at home, actually, that he has a famous quote that, you know, theater is my wife and film is my mistress or something like this, which, you know, given his serial infidelity, you know, has a lot of resonance. But we know him, of course, mostly for his films because that's what is mobile and transports. Right. But in Sweden, I mean, he did far more work in the theater. Hmm. And the staging of this opera is, and the directing is just so well done. The interactions between the characters that he helps to, you know, to produce is really fantastic. And so there's a lot of character and depth behind the characters that come out because of the staging. I mean, it's a really wonderful, you know, wonderful staging of the film, adaptation of the film. And something that really stood out to me was the kind of themes from Magic Flute that do have this kind of resonance still today. I mean, it's very much an Enlightenment, you know, product of the Enlightenment, this idea that human beings can be better, that they can improve themselves. Mm. But something else that, you know, kind of resonated with me is about how important love is in doing this, that it's in love that, you know, a couple can become better than they can become individually. And all of this is, you know, this kind of trajectory about, you know, the way that Pamina and Tamino, you know, find each other, and then together they go through these trials to become, I mean, in Mozart's words, they become like gods, right? Which is a really, you know, interesting and, you know, wonderful kind of message. So he plays, you know, the opera itself plays with this idea of, you know, what is good and what is evil. It's not always so clear-cut, right? That's when Tamino starts off on his quest. You know, he thinks he understands the way the world looks. He's kind of been seduced by the Queen of the Night and her perspective, but he comes to see that it's a little bit more complicated than that. Mm. And this kind of unveiling. So really wonderful. I mean, this is, you know, if you only see one opera film in your life, right, that this is the one that I would strongly recommend. And one of the things that's really nice too is that we were able to show a newly restored version of this. Criterion just came out with a new restoration of this film on Blu-ray, so it looks more brilliant than, you know, than we've ever seen it. Okay, I'll stop gushing about, you know, the magic flute now. Lastly, this week we had Man Killer, which is a documentary about Wilma Man Killer, really a hero in our times. Someone who, as I mentioned, was the first female to be the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. She was the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1998. She did get some recognition during her lifetime of what she did, but I think that, I mean, I certainly grew up not knowing who this person was and was really impressed by the power of her story.
Yeah.
One of the things that she was able to do, I think, is at a critical time for the Cherokee Nation and American Indians generally, is to restore some faith in the communities could have in themselves.
Yeah. Self-reliance was kind of a key theme.
Yeah, that seemed to, I mean, she was very progressive in her politics. She was kind of, her basic story is, you know, she's born in Oklahoma and in very impoverished conditions, as many Cherokee were there at that time. And as part of a kind of a systematic program to deal with the quote-unquote Indian problem, was relocated to San Francisco with her family. And this was both very empowering for her developmentally, but also devastating culturally, that she felt really torn away from, you know, from things. She makes the comment in the film that the difference of poverty with a community and poverty without a community are very different things. And when they were relocated to the Bay Area, they were living in Oakland, it was poverty without a community, largely. And that this is it taught her the importance of community, and she really became committed to this idea of helping American Indians to have faith in themselves and faith in their community. And so she's the positive elements of what she gets from being in the Bay Area was this political engagement. That of course the 1960s is a very hot time. Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco were kind of, ground zero for a lot of this. She becomes involved in the Native American occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969, and it kind of opens her eyes to that we have a kind of power if we decide to lay hold of it. She goes back to her own tradition and realizes that the things that kind of cultural practices of the Cherokee, how they were altered by European colonization. And one of the things that changed markedly was the power of women in the communities, right? That women traditionally, that is before contact with Europeans, it was the women in Cherokee society that owned property, that had custody of children, that were kind of the caretakers of culture. They had this kind of cultural power that was marginalized when the Cherokee began interacting with the Europeans, and the Europeans wouldn't recognize this power of the women. And so, of course, there's a whole kind of cultural genocide, story of cultural genocide, as they're driven out from the Southeast on the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma. Over a quarter of their entire population died during this time. And she goes back and resurrects a lot of these things to help the community to reestablish itself and to, as I said, kind of gain faith in what they're able to do. I guess the big takeaway for me was not only what a strong figure she was personally in standing up to a lot of opposition, both within the Cherokee Nation and without, at a time that women didn't have a lot of political power, but the importance of collective self-determination in these kinds of communities. It was not helpful that the federal government kept telling the Cherokee what they needed to do to fix their problems.
Right.
The Cherokee needed to kind of take ownership and to have the right to make mistakes, I guess, is part of it, right? And to try things. And when that began to happen, that's when, a kind of a difference, started to come about.
Yeah, and she was really a proponent of that idea of self-reliance.
Yeah. So a really kind of moving and inspirational story about a chapter of American history that I knew little about.
And a lot shorter than our other films that week.
Right? That's right.
I think Joseph mentioned
it goes on so long.
It was actually shorter than 74 minutes. I think it was closer to 50 minutes, apparently.
Yeah.
It was quite short, so
yeah.
Very digestible film.
That's exactly right. Well, let's turn now and preview the films for next week, the films from the 10th to the 13th of April. This will be our final week of films for the winter 2019 semester, and these films will include Giant, a Basque film, a Basque language film from 2017 by directors Jan Garaño and Aitor Aregi, Bad Genius, a Thai film directed by Natuut Punpiriya, I'm not saying that last name correctly, this is also from 2017, A Match Made by God, a 2008 musical comedy by Aditya Chopra, starring the king of Bollywood, Shah Rukh Khan. And then lastly, our documentary, Burma Storybook, a creative 2017 documentary by Czech director Peter Lohm about a country emerging from a dictatorship told through the nation's poetry. Giant is a film that is based on the life of Miguel Joaquin. Start getting into Basque names here. This is tricky. Miguel Joaquin Ilezigu Arteaga. I don't think I'm saying that right either. He lived in the 19th century, born in 1818, died in 1861. He suffered from giantism, right, which is a medical condition where you basically keep on growing. It was known as the giant from Alzo. So the film is about him and his brother. His brother kind of goes away, is in the military, he comes back and he finds his brother changed, right? And his brother becomes this kind of freak show attraction. And it's kind of coming to terms with that, seeing him as a human being and,
right,
and whatnot. This has garnered a lot of awards, both in Spain and internationally. I think in terms of a Basque language film, it's probably the film that's gotten the most attention. Which is, significant for a community that holds very fiercely on to its cultural identity.
Right, right.
Bad Genius. This is a timely...
Yeah, it really is. Well, around finals time, right? It's a Thai film, and it's a little bit unlike a lot of the Thai films. Some of the Thai films maybe we've shown at IC, which are a little bit more of a dreamy kind of style of filmmaking. This is a film that borrows from kind of a global genre style of kind of the heist, the thriller. But it's also speaking to a regional audience in the sense that it's dealing with school culture, which is a major theme in a lot of melodrama in Asia. So that, you know, it's kind of speaking to that audience, particularly the examination system of getting into high school, getting to colleges, you know, which is something that is obviously school entrance examinations is an issue that is, going on in America as well. But this kind of intense pressure that's placed on students to do well in these exams. I think that in some ways in Asian culture, Southeast Asian culture, you're taking exams or in some ways a lot of weight is placed on those for determining entrance into schools. And so the over the top nature that you'll notice in this film, the kind of almost operatic way in which the action is handled in some ways maybe speaks to that kind of anxiety. About test taking that
it's
you get
like
there.
It's like deadline narrative after deadline narrative
right.
after deadline.
Right, just like
right, that you're
constant kind of about taking tests. So, yeah.
Hopefully this will be cathartic for students during finals.
Yeah, hopefully it won't be instructive, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And the next film is also operatic in its own way as well. We're kind of continuing this theme a little bit, but this is the Bollywood film, A Match Made by God from 2008. And I think what you have to do to really enjoy this film is to really just kind of give yourself over to the Bollywood, you know, because, you know, you're going to get, it's a, you know, they're musicals, right?
Right.
And so you're going to get singing, you're going to get dancing, which is really enjoyable. I mean, this is really one of the really great choreographed dance pieces, a lot of them, right?
Yeah, this is one of the most successful Bollywood films, I think, of all time.
It seems like it, and it has a great story. You know, it's always about melodrama. It's always about kind of the boy meets girl story. And you really just have to kind of accept that you're going to get a long film. And this one is actually comes in as one of the shorter, apparently, Bollywood films, close to 3 hours.
It's interesting that there's a different understanding of what a narrative arc is, right, in different cultures. And like you're saying, it's not about getting from point A to point B narratively. It's about the journey.
it really is.
It's about the musical numbers that can be inserted along the way and the spectacle.
Right.
It's about that spectacle.
And I think we've kind of been conditioned to, when we hit this 2-hour mark in films, that we almost kind of lose attention or something about it with kind of our modern Hollywood films and media. But there's this idea that maybe the more the better, right? I think this is kind of traditionally before the era of kind of the saturation of media. I mean, going to the theater was an event, and really, you know, you'd want to be there as long as you can, right?
Yeah.
And a short film is almost like you're cheating you of this experience. And so you kind of have to give yourself over to that and really to enjoy, you know, the Bollywood film. So
it'll be fun to see this on the big screen, too, because it is about the visual spectacle.
It's very much
some
spectacle.
Some of these choreographed dance numbers that involve large crowds of people and large sets. Yeah, this will be help relieve stress during finals time. The documentary that we'll be playing this week is Burma Storybook. This is directed by Peter Loem and Corinne van Egeraat, a Netherlands-based creative team. And it's looking at the poetic imaginings of the political prisoner and poet Maung Aung Pwint from Burma, or Myanmar as it's called now. And it really is this visual poem that I say it's looking at, you know, this particular poet, one of the best known poets from this area, but it kind of centers around, he kind of comes back to it, but it's a visual poem about Burmese life, interspersed with these portraits of various poets returning to this one particularly prominent poet. It makes the point at the beginning of the film that most Burmese write and can recite poetry by heart. Mm. And, you know, this is something that I think has been lost, an art form that certainly poetry is very much with us, but not like it was once upon a time, right? That there's a lot of other art forms that compete with it. And this idea of memorizing poetry is not something that we find as often in the West, and maybe has something to do with the isolation of this culture historically, that it was politically so isolated. But that, you know, what does it mean when you know, a people are connected by poetry, it's exploring that kind of thing. And it's a visual poem. You can think about the whole film as being poetic in its sensibility. It's not about the narrative per se. There is a narrative that's being followed, and that we keep coming back to this particular dissident poet who's waiting to be reunited with his son. But visually, the film is just is really interesting. You get these really interesting insights into what everyday life is like in Burma without a lot of commentary necessarily. And the commentary that does come is poetic in nature. That kind of gives you something to chew on and to think about. Very evocative. And the photography is really beautiful. I mean, it's it kind of recognizes what it's trying to do, and in that it wants to give you images that are poetic. That is an image that's not easily digested, that has an aesthetic appeal to you, but also leaves you with something to chew on and something to think about, something that kind of sticks with you maybe several days. And so this is, I think this is a great documentary to send out the semester on.
Yeah, that's right, the end of the semester.
Well, thank you for joining us today on From the Booth. You can find more information about each of these films by visiting the International Cinema website, ic.byu.edu, where you can also find information about upcoming films, lectures, and events at IC, as well as podcasts about previous week's films. From the Booth is produced by the International Cinema Program, who gets its unfaltering support from the BYU College of Humanities. Nevertheless, the hosts of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't necessarily represent any official position adopted by the college, university, or supporting institutions. We thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, for helping us to sound our best, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and College Web Team for their vital logistical support. We hope you join us next week, where we'll be discussing the films that are showing at International Cinema. Until then, we hope to see you in 250 of the Kimball Tower. Thanks, Mark.
See you next time.